Welcome to Who Cares Wins, with me, Lily Cole.
We cannot eat coal and we cannot drink oil.
The bathtub of the sky is overflowing with too much carbon.
Science needs to get out of the silo.
We have unequivocal scientific evidence that we need to decarbonize the world in 30 years. And companies like Shell has an enormous task to play in this transition. We need to sit down and just try to walk this through very carefully of how can we really start the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era that we all need to have any chance of survival on planet Earth.
And this is the message that you may not want to hear, that the world still uses oil and gas, and therefore oil and gas needs to be produced.
We have hit rock bottom in our addictions to fossil fuels.
No matter what he says today, remember, Shell has spent millions covering up the warnings from climate scientists, bribing politicians and even paying soldiers to kill Nigerian activists fighting against them.
You can't have a strategy that is dependent on society failing at its goals.
At the heart of every issue that intersects with the environment, you find contradictions, tensions, and divergent perspectives. And these issues are complex and changing. Most of us want a happy life and a healthy planet. But many people have different ideas about the right way to travel towards it. In this new podcast series, I'll be sharing parts of my research from my book, Who Cares Wins, interviewing some of the leading and conflicting voices in contemporary debates, such as technology, food, gender, politics, and looking at how they intersect with our environment. I see myself a bit like sellotape, ribbon or string, holding together divergent voices and sort of asking, who cares who wins? Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of Who Cares Wins, which I've created in the context of COP26, the climate summit that's happening in Glasgow right now. So something interesting happened in the weeks running up to COP26. I was contacted by the comedian Joe Lycett, who asked me if I'd make a kind of advert for Shell. And when I looked at his work and the pitch for the documentary and the research around it, I jumped on board. The advert was published shortly afterwards and sounded a bit like this.
Hi, I'm Shell CEO Ben Van Bird. Here at Shell, we are powering progress. We have set out clear plans on how we are going to reduce our absolute emissions by 2030. I'm sorry, I have shut out of my mouth. Where was I? Oh yes, because we care about our planet, Shell won't invest in any new oil fields and will cancel our membership of any groups that lobby against climate change policy. This isn't greenwashing. This is the truth. Don't look at me. This cuts a Lily Cole stroking a kitten.
Hi, I'm here to distract you from the CEO of Shell shitting out of his mouth.
At Shell, we're committed to showing you lots of pictures of forests and windmills so that you guys think that we're greener than we actually are. Oh, yeah. That bit actually was true.
So, you get the gist. What does greenwashing mean? Well, there's a lot of greenwashing happening on lots of levels of society, governments, companies, etc. It's where there's a kind of distance between the marketing and the messaging around how green a company is or how green a government is being and the reality. And as sustainability is becoming more and more popular and there's more and more awareness around the need for climate action, there is a slippery space emerging of ambiguity where people are claiming and companies are claiming that they're greener than they actually are. I mean, the data on Shell is pretty compelling. They've positioned themselves as a leader in the fossil fuel energy space on shifting towards renewables. And yet, if you look at their actual spending, they spend billions of dollars still on oil exploration, even though in 2021, the International Energy Agency, which is the biggest agency around energy in the world, said that there's no need for any new oil fields anywhere in the planet. Last year, 2020, Shell spent more on oil exploration than on renewables. And in their official financial expenditure stats for 2020, they spent nearly 20 times more on fossil fuels than on renewables. And meanwhile, they're spending literally billions on marketing. So imagine my surprise when a few weeks after making the advert, just before it came out, I found myself at the TED Talks in Edinburgh, the TED Countdown, which was the climate solutions focused TED Talks in the run-up to COP26 in Glasgow. And I was sitting in the audience, and guess who was on stage? Christiana Figueres was introducing.
And we also have Ben van Beurden, who probably also needs no introduction. He has been the CEO of Shell since 2014. He has 30 years of experience in Shell, in both the upstream and downstream parts of Shell. And he has vowed to take Shell to net zero by 2050. This conversation is about decarbonizing the oil and gas. There are many people here in the audience and many more outside who have honestly devoted most, if not all, of their life to addressing climate change. Now, you have been very vocal, Ben, about the fact that Shell is a leader in this space. I have to tell you that there are people here and outside who may not quite be convinced of this. So this is your opportunity to convince all of us that Shell truly is a leader in this space. Over to you.
First of all, the message is, I get it. We get it. Shell gets it. We believe, indeed, very significant more action is going to be needed. We share the concern. We personally, I share, my company shares the anxiety of what is going on at the moment. And we want to be on the right side of history. We have a strategy of getting to net zero by 2050. The mission to come up with a plan to reduce our own emissions by 50% by 2030. And we're working very hard on that right now. But that's not enough, of course, because it is not just about our emissions, it's about the emissions of our customers. That is by far the biggest part of the footprint that we have. And that means that we have to create an entirely different company. That means that we have to work sector by sector, figuring out how we're going to decarbonize aviation, heavy-duty road transport, shipping, steelmaking, etc. We have gone back into wind. We gave up wind 15 years ago, which was a strategic mistake. But we're back into it, and we're bidding on wind farms, we're winning tenders, we're constructing them, and right now we are using some of this green power to build hydrogen plants for road transport. And last Monday, we took the next few steps on a $1 billion hydrogen plant electrolyzer in Rotterdam without there being a single customer identified yet, because there are not too many hydrogen trucks in Europe. We're building the largest biofuel plant for aviation in Europe as well at this point in time. We're investing this year only $100 million in nature, and we do this year on year on year. But I have a final message as well, and this is the message that you may not want to hear. And that message is that the world still uses oil and gas. And therefore, oil and gas needs to be produced, responsibly so. And that is also part of our mission, and I'm not ashamed of that, because the world needs it. But even more so, if we are going to be successful with the energy transition that I'm describing and the acceleration that I want to do and the tens of billions of dollars that we want to invest in it, that needs to be funded as well. And that cannot be funded by the renewables business that we have. So we need the legacy business to fund the strategy for the future.
Now, the decision to invite Ben van der Beurden to speak at the TED Countdown Summit had been quite a contentious one. And from the moment I arrived at the conference, there were lots of people giving different opinions about whether he should have been platformed, shouldn't have been platformed, etc. And it was interesting to see those types of reactions. And to me, it sort of perfectly manifested the different ways that people protest. And I personally don't think there's a right or wrong way. I think that everyone has to do what's right for them. And actually, different types of approaches are helpful. But you have people who try and change the system from the inside and therefore are willing to engage and want dialogue and feel like dialogue is important. And may go as far even as to become an investor in a company to try and change its practices. And then people who want change from the outside, you know, who will deplatform and not engage. And that was the approach that was taken by many of the youth activists who are in attendance at TED. And so brought to the stage alongside Ben van der Burden, were two people who represented these two kind of polarized possibilities. So Chris James, who's an activist investor, who managed to get three directors on the board of Exxon, the energy company, through becoming a major shareholder in the company, to try and make the company change direction, which he says going in a climate-friendly direction is better for business. But of course, that's also better for the planet. And also on stage was the youth climate activist, Lauren McDonald, who's a campaigner for Stop Cambo. And she and the other youth activists took a slightly different approach.
I just want to give a little bit of context. So Shell and Siccar Point Energy are trying to push a new oil field through the UK Parliament, the Cambo oil field, which is going to be off the coast of Scotland, which obviously is my home. So, Mr. van Buuren, I just want to start by saying that you should be absolutely ashamed of yourself for the devastation, that you have caused to communities all over the world. Already, you are responsible for so much death and suffering. No matter what he says today, remember, Shell has spent millions covering up the warnings from climate scientists, bribing politicians and even paying soldiers to kill Nigerian activists fighting against them. All whilst rebranding to make it look as though they care and that they have the intention of changing. Disproportionately, in the global south, so many people are already dying due to issues related to the climate crisis, such as pollution, extreme heat, and weather-related disasters. If you're going to sit here and say you care about climate action, why are you currently appealing the recent court ruling that Shell must decrease its emissions by 45% by 2030? I will not be sharing this podium with you anymore. I do not agree with Shell being given this platform, and I'm really appreciative that I was given the chance to come up here and speak today, but my soul cannot stand or sit here or whatever and be next to someone that is making me have this visceral reaction. Thank you for listening.
So at this point in the conference, Lauren's walked out. Youth activists have stood up, gone to the front of the stage, apparently the first protest ever at TED Talk, and held up signs and then exited the room.
At the bottom of what we just heard is deep pain. And I would just encourage everyone to close your eyes for a moment and get in touch with that pain that, frankly, we all share. We all deal with it differently. We all deal with it differently. But we all share in the pain of what we have all lost. And there is a huge opportunity for us to stand in that pain and at the same time rise to the power that is within us to make this change in a timely fashion. But if we don't stand in our own pain, we can have no compassion for the pain that we've just heard. Can you beat that one, Chris? This is quite a challenge.
I wouldn't try.
Now, I was sitting there and I was just burning up because suddenly there was this void on stage. Suddenly you had two men, both very business savvy, ready just to have a conversation about the business of energy. And there was really no one, it seemed, there to really properly challenge and scrutinize what Ben van der Burden was going to say. And it made it just feel like a potential greenwashing exercise. And it sort of felt like a bit of divine intervention, considering I just got all these Shell stats in the back of my head. And meanwhile, someone from the back of the audience probably had a similar reaction to me and sort of shouting out, you know, no, we can't carry on. There needs to be an activist there. There needs to be a woman there.
So, Chris.
Seriously, we've got to the missing place. The activist needs to be there to ask the question.
And I took that as my cue, and my hands shot up, and I asked a question. And so I used the most conservative legal figures we can use. And I said, I was aware that Shell are investing at least four times as much in fossil fuels compared to renewables. And based on that data and other data, how can they be positioning themselves as a leader in the move towards green energy? And my kind of simple question was, could he look himself in the mirror? Could Ben van der Burden look himself in the mirror and truly, honestly believe he wasn't part of an effort of greenwashing the planet right now?
I understand that question. And let me cut to the chase and say, we need to do more. We need to put more money in the technologies that are the future of energy. But there's a few things that I want you to consider as well. First of all, our legacy business, oil and gas, is so much more capital intensive. So in other words, if you want to keep that business from imploding, you have to invest to just allow it to shrink a little bit. So you cannot quite compare capital as the best proxy for intent or progress or whatever else. But the other thing also is, there is a rate of change that is acceptable for a company to follow. Everybody thinks of renewables as, that's solar and wind. But solar and wind is not going to do anything for aviation, for shipping, not even for heavy-duty road transport. If we have to build those technologies, the hydrogen technologies, the sustainable aviation fuel technologies, and the like, we have to actually work with customers to also take risk. And therefore, yes, as I gave as an example for the hydrogen plant, I'm prepared to put $1 billion out there without a customer, a single customer being there, but I can't do 10 of them. We have to make this happen in a pace that is acceptable. And it needs to be funded by these legacy businesses as well. So I cannot let them die or wither on the vine tomorrow, because that basically means that my transition capacity is gone as well. But don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to make an excuse for staying in a business that I'm comfortable with. We have basically said that business goodbye in terms of our long-term strategy. But we need it in order to fund the future of energy.
To his credit, he answered the question, which he didn't have to. He didn't really answer the actual question, can you look yourself in the mirror? Which was the kind of human element, I guess, I really genuinely wanted to ask, because, you know, I believe everyone's human, and that's the level on which we need to have these conversations, is the shared humanity that we each have, whatever position we're in. So it's an interesting answer, isn't it? Essentially sort of saying we have to keep growing our fossil fuel business in order to afford to fund the green transition, which sort of makes sense, you know, in a kind of business logic way, which doesn't make sense with science. And it doesn't make sense with what the International Energy Agency said is necessary in terms of energy production right now. So let's hear a bit from Chris James, who was the activist investor, on his experience working inside Exxon.
We have tried, even throughout the course of the Exxon campaign, to not be prescriptive. And I say that because there's an enormous amount of information. You can't have a strategy that is dependent on society failing at its goals. I think that what all companies have to do is align their own strategy with what ultimately their customers, i.e. society, wants. Every company has a different skill set. Exxon invented the lithium-ion battery. Exxon was the first person to scale solar. Like, there are some incredible engineering talent inside of these companies, but they have not been focused in the right area. And we use the slogan, re-energize Exxon, but what we really meant is unleash the power of engineering to solve this problem. What we do know is that in this current world of transparency, customers want to align their purchasing decisions with their own values. Mm-hmm. So I think that the transparency and openness, I know this wasn't easy for Ben to get up here. I can tell you, big oil companies, they surround themselves typically by all lifers inside of the same company. They work in a vacuum, and I don't think they really, until recently, really understood the scale of this transition. There was a fundamental belief that the world was going to develop, and they had to help the world develop. And obviously, it was not the correct view. Every company has to deal with this issue. When I say this issue, this climate issue, whether it's Microsoft or Google or Exxon. I mean, this is everyone's problem. And companies are the only people that have the scale to affect change.
We have 30 million customers a day. And we have a lot of B2B customers that all want to make a pledge of being net zero, but then quite don't know how to do it. And that, I think, is where our strength is. Because if you think that all of this, risk-taking, large optimization, creative contracting, risk harboring in your trading organizations is going to be done by new companies, by startup companies, or by iPhone apps, that's not going to be the case. It needs to be sophisticated companies like us, who then indeed need to understand how they need to shift their profiles.
I actually wanted to turn our attention here at the end to the next generation. and ask each of you to give us very shortly one concluding message that brings in the richness of this discussion, plus the pain that we heard, and bring all of that together, and each of you have an opportunity to give us one message for those for whom we're all working. Because honestly, it's not about us, right? We're all working for the next generation. So, just one concluding message.
I have four children, three daughters. My middle daughter, who is almost 15, once asked me, "Is it true, Papa, that you are destroying the planet?" Because that's what they teach at school. It's very hard to explain hydrogen and CCS and everything else to, at that point in time, an 11-year-old. And the only thing I could muster at that point in time in terms of explanation is, "You know I love you. Do you trust me to do the right thing for you?" And she said, "Yes." But that message is not going to work with the outside world, nor with my daughter, for that matter, in 10 years' time. So the only way that I am going to be able to look my daughter in the eye in 10 years' time is there are a different set of facts on the table to show that we have acted. And that is my commitment, and I genuinely mean that, even though I do realize that a lot of people will not take my word for it. And I'm okay with that as well, because at some point in time, a different set of facts will emerge around Shell that you cannot deny.
Chris, your concluding message?
I understand. I think people should be, they should be angry. It's okay to be angry, but it's not okay to not do anything. My final thought on this is the idea, if you're angry, like, do something about it. Don't divest. Vote. You have the ability to democratize capitalism. You have the ability to vote your shares. You have the ability to get involved. Don't run away from the problem, because then that just leaves somebody else to fix it.
Now, thank God, towards the end, we had another intervention. The wonderful Gail Whiteman, who's a scientist who I got to know last year in Davos, because she founded something called Arctic Base Camp, which brings science and climate science in particular to spaces of power.
One question, Gail Whiteman, I'm a scientist, and I just thought that there should be science on the table. We've looked at the feasibility scenarios of the Shell Sky scenario and many of the others. So I'd like to ask Johan Rockström to come up and just very briefly put a little bit of science back in.
Well, I mean, just to remind ourselves why we're here, we have unequivocal scientific evidence that we need to decarbonize the world in 30 years. Now, it's not a chicken and egg situation here. We need to have all hands on deck. And companies like Shell, as you are so well aware of, Ben, is responsible and has an enormous task to play in this transition, in dialogue with civil society, business, policy, and us in the scientific community. We recently did a study on your Shell Sky scenarios that you claim are aligned with 1.5 degrees Celsius. They're actually scientifically not correct, because you're continuing a very slow pace of decarbonization and kind of factoring in with offsets through utopian plantation of trees, which is scientifically a very questionable way of running your pathway's future. And I would suggest, therefore, that what we need is to sit down calmly between yourself with the youth movement. I mean, Lauren here expressed emotion in a way that can be translated, as we know so well, Christiana, in a very factual base, because they're so knowledgeable, all the youth that are out there now screaming for the change. And if we could meet down in a dialogue between yourself, science, policy, and civil society, and just try to walk this through very carefully of how can we really start the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era that we all need to have any chance of survival on planet Earth. I hope we can take that together.
This is the reason why I'm here. I do believe a dialogue is needed. I understand how difficult it is. I feel the anxiety and the pain in a different way. And as I said earlier on, we want to be on the right side of history as well. So yes, by all means, let's have the dialogue. We should also be allowed to invest $100 million a year in nature. And if that is being seen as greenwashing, then I would say, well, actually, no, then you are blackwashing me. So I take your invite and I will be there.
Now, there you go. You heard it. A meeting has been agreed and we can all follow up and see that that actually does happen. I also think we need to have dialogue between people with different interests just to see if we can actually move the needle on where we need to go. and really have a reality check on the claims that they are making. Because ultimately, like he said, it's his own children too. It's all of our children. You can't negotiate with science. Doesn't matter what the business logic might be. Science doesn't give a fuck about business logic. It's not going to change its mind about how quickly the ice is going to melt or how quickly the droughts and heat waves are going to increase based on their business plan. So following that experience, which was pretty heated to say the least, I reached out to Gail and asked her if she would speak to me a bit about the climate science and specifically the work they'd done looking at Shell's report so we could get a better understanding of where we're at in this most critical part of dealing with the climate crisis, energy, fossil fuels. And here's what she had to say. Talk to me about when we ran into each other very recently at the TED conference. I'd love to hear it from your point of view. When you first heard that the talk was happening, how you responded and your experience of the event itself.
I think the idea of having a dialogue with a CEO from the fossil fuel sector is important, whether it's, you know, main stage talk or not is, I think, debatable. But I think having the conversation is important. And so I didn't have an issue that there was a conversation. I guess my concern was that there wasn't science on stage along with those speakers. And I think that's really important to have that. We had Johan Rockström, myself, and a number of other researchers at Potsdam University and beyond had actually published in June of this year a paper looking at what were the feasibility criteria for all the pathways that everybody's talking about, whether that's the Shell Sky scenario or the International Energy Agency or some of the scenarios that are in the IPCC report. These are thrown about and it's hard to say which are more viable than not. So that paper tried to do the first stab at saying from a scientific perspective, what actually is the feasibility corridor of various different dimensions within that? And then analyzing many of these pathways to see if they would actually get us to the 1.5 ceiling, which could prevent a catastrophic climate change. And I was very strong at including Shell in that analysis because they're masters at doing scenario planning. They were, of course, the leading corporate doing that from the 1980s onward. And their Shell Sky scenario is beautifully named, Sky scenario. Who wants to argue with that? And actually very powerfully conveyed within a multi-sector business audience. People know what Shell is doing. And many of those companies, of course, rely on some form of energy. And certainly it's still a mix of fossil fuel, oil and gas, et cetera. And the analysis that we did, which we launched just before the Shell annual general meeting in June of this year of 2021, showed that the Shell Sky scenario did not fall within the feasibility range. It was vastly outside what our collection of scientists felt was a reasonable set of criteria to make sure that we were in a feasibility range. That paper was peer reviewed. It wasn't easy to publish. You know, of course, like any academic paper, we've got others out there saying, you've got to get this tighter, that tighter, et cetera, et cetera. So the very fact that we could publish that in Environmental Research Letters, I think showed that this is a serious attempt at grappling with this problem. So from my perspective, the session simply did not have any of that or an acknowledgement of that. It seemed to me as not just a tremendously missed opportunity, but concerned me deeply because it pitted the Shell CEO against either investor pressure, which can be a very successful approach, and look at, you know, getting the environmental board members on Exxon is a great example of that, or against the youth movement, which has also a very valid and very specific perspective. But there's then the science that regardless of where you may sit in an emotional basis on the issue, this paper really starts to challenge Shell and others. These are the criteria. And of course, they could publish a counter argument and say our criteria are wrong or need to be improved. And that's how science works. And, you know, we would welcome continued work in improving those criteria that we said in that paper, but not to have that at all discussed, probably because they didn't know about what we were doing. They didn't ask the scientists. And this idea that science sits on the side, to me, is really problematic. That's why we had set up Arctic Base Camp to put a direct information flow between science and people with power. So it's not like the scientists sit in some nerdy room in the back and they are brought out when people want the climate change 101. But it's actually that the scientists should be alongside any discussion on solutions. So that for me was the biggest problem. I was completely shocked. I just assumed that there would be some discussion of that.
When you say that your peer-reviewed scientific paper on Shell's Sky Plan sees it fall outside the feasibility pathways, can you kind of explain what that means and the risks or possibilities implicit in that?
So the two biggest problems with Shell are that they are not looking at really reducing emissions sufficiently fast enough. Instead, what they're doing is they are relying in a wholly unrealistic way on various forms of carbon capture and storage. Some of those are technological, huge, wide scale, absolutely never before tested amounts of technologically carbon capture and storage, which, wow, if it was a silver bullet and it worked, would be great. But that's a lot to bet the whole farm on, the whole world on. But secondly, also using nature-based carbon capture and storage, which would be, say, planting trees. But the amount of forest that would need to be planted to actually meet what they were saying they would rely on in their scenario is just unrealistic from the amount of land that's available globally to do that. You know, and then other pathways were evaluated, of course, fell short on other dimensions.
So according to Gail and Johan Rockström, the Shell Sky scenario would see them plant trees in a region the size of Brazil. Now, there's a few problems with that. We've only got a limited amount of land. Another problem is that trees can go up in flames. And actually, last year, Microsoft and BP had a big carbon offsetting program of tree planting that literally went up in flames in forest fires. So it's a vulnerable approach, which is not to say I'm against planting trees and nature-based solutions, but to kind of use that as our only policy by which we're trying to stabilize the planet is a risky strategy. And then a third very important point to make is who owns the land and what's the relationship of companies to the land that they're investing in? Because actually, a lot of conservation projects have been very controversial because they've stepped on and used indigenous land, often excluding the indigenous communities from having access to land that was historically theirs. In Glasgow for COP26, I worked with Flourishing Diversity to organise several indigenous listening sessions. And as part of those, we spoke to Ariel Chechwi Duranja.
There were river systems that I used to swim in and play in as a child that are either completely gone altogether because these oil and gas companies drain our river systems to extract the oil from the ground. The process is not like anything you've ever seen before. For one barrel of oil, it takes 4 barrels of fresh water from our river systems to extract tar sands. To create 1 barrel of oil, you need 3 barrels of natural gas to produce 1 barrel of tar sands. This oil is going across the globe because we have hit rock bottom in our addictions to fossil fuels. In our communities, we are standing up. We are challenging these infrastructures. We are challenging the commodification of our lands and territories to be traded in carbon offsets because right next to the tar sands, they are creating the largest conservation area in the world. And guess who is buying it? Shell Oil, Exxon, Husky, name those big corporations because they have a vested interest not only in destroying our land, but owning what's remaining and what's left that we have protected as indigenous people so that they can trade it, so they can continue to have neocolonialism in this day and age by continuing to take our lands, invisibilize our voices, demonize our values and cultures as indigenous peoples. And we stand up. We are resilient. We walk even further for our water. We fight even harder for our voices. But here in these spaces, we don't have a seat at the table. So we come and we are loud in the streets with delegations that Tom Goldtooth and IEN and other indigenous organizations have organized to ensure that our voices are no longer ignored, so that people can understand what it means to be Kaitale Dene Sotlene, to know what it means to be in relationship with the natural world, to know what it means to understand the stories of the water, the stories of the land, the stories of the sky, the stories of who we are as indigenous peoples, and how those stories provide us answers and pathways to solutions that are not locked in markets and capitalism systems of domination and war and violence, but in relationship and reciprocity with the land and with each other.
Ariel's concerns were echoed by her friend and colleague, Tom Goldtooth, from the Navajo Diné community. Tom is executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network and speaks eloquently of the new challenges faced by Indigenous communities as companies and governments use offsetting as a way to drive net zero goals.
The bathtub of the sky is overflowing with too much carbon. It's overflowing with too much greenhouse gases. So what are the solutions that we saw coming out of this conference of the parties, of the governments, of the world? What does this have to do with our indigenous knowledge? Because the main mechanism that has been developed in those hallways is around the financialization of nature, the commodification of the sacred, the privatization. Before you trade carbon in the trading market system, you got to determine whose property right it is. Carbon, air, atmosphere, even the trees. The carbon is the trading mechanism. So some of you may offset your trip in the airplane. You feel good about yourself. The indulgences of the Catholic Church to pay money to relieve yourself of your guilt. Who owns the trees? It's the polluters who are buying the carbon credits in the trees. So the carbon in the trees becomes their trees. So they have little park reserves with their own little police systems to keep our people out of there now.
So the critical issue seems to be not whether Shell and fossil fuel companies like them are planting trees, but specifically, are they stopping fossil fuel exploration?
I mean, I think Ben van der Burden was very clear at TED Countdown, even more recently than that Shell Sky scenario, that Shell and other oil and gas majors would continue to develop fossil fuel because the consumer and business demand was out there for it. They had reduced their renewable portfolio. Ben van der Burden admitted on the stage at TED that that was probably a mistake. That was 10 years ago. Now, of course, many of the executives at Shell were part of that earlier decision. But from a science perspective, that is crazy to have reduced renewables 10 years ago. So, you know, they have quite a strong vested interest in business as usual and hoping, of course, for these technological fixes. And there was a major court case in the Netherlands that challenged Shell, and they won, that their ambition was just not significant enough. And they are now having to invest more in renewables. But that was because of a court case. That is not because it was an executive strategy decision. So it's still insufficient. And they are not reducing fossil fuel. They are saying, well, the world needs energy. And economically, sure, that sounds very reasonable. The problem is it will just take us to such an unsafe space that the rest of the world, we cannot afford to let that kind of conversation continue unchallenged.
I mean, that's what, I mean, we were both sitting in the audience at TED and we both interrupted the conversation to speak out. Yeah. And for me, that was why I was so upset and frustrated watching it play out, because it felt that Ben van der Burden wasn't being challenged. And there was a kind of business conversation that was going on that's, of course, very reasonable. And there's lots of reasonable excuses that can be made as to why, you know, they're not able to change quickly enough and why these decisions are being made, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, science doesn't negotiate, you know, it's not an intellectual conversation you can have with science to say, yeah, well, our business model doesn't let us go move faster than this.
Yeah, exactly. And if that means that Shell then wants to ask governments for help with what are then going to become stranded assets, well, go ahead, have those conversations. All science can do is that this is not feasible. So we cannot follow this trajectory. We cannot follow this scenario. If we do, we will all absolutely pay a very serious price for it.
And by the way, that's baffling to me that still today there are billions being paid in direct fossil fuel subsidies by governments and trillions if you count the unallocated social environmental costs of fossil fuels. So it's just, It's kind of insane to me that the political lobbying that's been going on from fossil fuel companies to governments in order to support and prop up the fossil fuel industry hasn't just been essentially redirected. You know, it's like, yes, we need support to change. Can we change the types of subsidies we're getting and the support we're getting to change quicker?
Yeah, exactly. And then if you take a look at the whole low carbon transformation needs increased capital, well, let's redirect it. Let's go faster. It's mind-boggling to me. It's what part of the science aren't people getting or paying attention to? And I really think it's got to be insular. And they start to believe the fact, well, we can't do this economically. Yeah, we can. And you know, Lily, we have clearly learned that with COVID. You know, when we were in Davos in 2020, coming out of there, we had no idea that shortly the most world governments would close their borders, close office spaces, really reduce the economy, have to pump all this money back in terms of furlough schemes and many other subsidies, and actually scale up to deal with an existential risk that medical science had been warning about. And they just simply had not prepared for, thinking, oh, that won't happen, even though all the indications from the medical world was, this is real, this will happen, here's how you get prepared. And people did scenarios and then ignored them. And yet we learned that's really expensive. That's very expensive, not just in terms of economics, but human lives and livelihoods. I mean, that's just a warm-up act. You know, there's no vaccine for a changing climate. So we need to learn from COVID and learn that actually the argument of this doesn't make sense in a regular economic world just doesn't cut it, because once rubber hits the road, it's going to become much more expensive. I think the bottom line is that, you know, there are no silver bullets. And that was the title of our paper. There are no silver bullets. We have to do all of these things. There will have to be some form of carbon capture and storage, but we cannot bet the entire future of the world that will fix it. We have to just reduce emissions, and we have to shift to renewables rapidly. And I think rationally, we need to have these conversations with the CEOs of oil and gas companies. And then we need to get them to commit to no new fossil fuel investment starting now. And that's not just a scientist saying this or the youth movement or civil society. That is now what the International Energy Agency also published in June of this year. No new fossil fuel development if we want to stay within the 1.5C window. That is what the science says. And anybody that chooses to go elsewhere is no longer following the science. And they're putting us all at risk.
And what is that risk for people who are not familiar? Like, what is the risk of 1.5? You know, sometimes it sounds like jargon. What is that risk?
Well, anything above the 1.5 Celsius warmer world means, for example, major ecoregions around the world will start to change dramatically. If you take the Arctic, which I'm the most familiar with, at that point, it looks like we will lose the Arctic summer sea ice. And again, that might sound not, you know, that worrying if you're far away from it, you know, if you're in San Francisco or London or Prague. But actually, because the white of the Arctic sea ice acts as an insurance policy, it bounces back heat, which means when it's gone, the oceans just get that much warmer, which means there's an amplification of climate change by the estimates are up 25 to 40% increase in global warming through loss of the sea ice, which then kicks off the permafrost thaw on the land. So how will that affect you everywhere? Through things like extreme weather events, there'll be an increase in whether that's droughts, fires, floods, storm surges, just strange weather patterns which affect agriculture. So food and water security becomes difficult when the whole seasons for growing the food that we consume are shifting. And they're shifting geographies, they're shifting seasons. And that means just the world gets so much more difficult. And we know that this means people will have to move. This means forced migration, which means conflict. It just goes on and on and on. So the issues of a 1.5C above warmer world, we will feel that. We will feel that with health impacts. So these really super hot cities where, you know, there was a place out in Canada in Lytton, British Columbia this year where, you know, it was 48 degrees Celsius. So that's kind of the temperature of Dubai. And let me tell you, as a Canadian, that's not our normal summer temperature. And you know, that town, it was an astronomically hot period. And no surprise, the next day that town burnt down in a forest fire in 15 minutes or something, you know, a very short period of time. And that's just not Canada. You know, Canada has, some parts have nice summers, but we never get to 48 degrees. That's just unlivable pretty much anywhere. And we just have to make sure that this doesn't happen. So, you know, threats to food and water security, threats to our way of life, you know, extreme weather, you know, it's just not going to be pretty. There's going to be big economic costs along with that.
For a skeptic listening, of which I think there are less and less, but there are still some that would say that the planet has always changed temperature. We know that from archaeological records. What's different about this type of climate change?
Yeah, so I think that the planet has always changed temperature, but the science is clear that the temperature changes we are seeing now globally and regionally are driven much more rapidly by human-induced CO2 emissions. So that is going to put us into a state that humans have not existed within, especially in such large numbers. So it's a whole new game that we really don't know what that's going to look like and what that's going to mean for so many billions of people that want to live their lives well. It's a wild card, and I just don't think it's worth the risk.
Agreed.
You know, I'd just like to say thanks to you to reaching out to scientists, because the one thing we don't really know how to do very well is actually reach people and get our knowledge out there so that people know that we have to really challenge oil and gas companies and governments that are subsidizing them. It doesn't make sense, and we will pay the price. So we need people like you, Lily, who actually know how to reach people, whether it's on the podcast or social media or through your network, because, you know, people just don't invite scientists on the stage when we should be there. And I think that was a good example at TED last week.
For sure. When I wrote my book, I interviewed the environmental advisor to President Macron at the time. And it was interesting that he was reflecting on, as many politicians have, you know, the power of lobbying and the insidiousness of lobbying in recent decades, and how that's kind of compromised politicians' ability to really do what they need to do. And he said that he was made much more optimistic in the last few years because of the youth climate movement and the different climate movements around the world that are starting to act as a kind of counterforce to lobbying, and lobbying in a different way to governments, that kind of tipping point is being reached. And I think the fact that there was such a strong reaction to the Shell CEO at the TED Talk, with the youth climate activists choosing to protest in the way that they did, I think is testament to the fact that there is a kind of grassroots lobbying of ordinary citizens making their voices heard, listening to the science and trying to respond to that in a human way that hopefully will be the counterforce we need to the crazy lobbying that's happened for decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that idea that it's actually the counterforce to lobbying. And I guess that's where we have to have these unusual collaborations, where we all share the knowledge that we have and get out of there. And science definitely needs to get out of the silo. You know, we actually have to, you know, follow the lead of people like James Hansen, who have been doing that since the 1980s, where he as a scientist has been bringing climate change into the discussions, political, governmental, and just in the press. And we need to do more of it.
It also requires, I think, a slightly longer term thinking, right, than the 4 or 5 year political cycles ask of what's 50
Absolutely.
Years, what's 100 years, and how do we use science to understand those risks?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Gail. That was really wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I'm sure I'll see you in COP.
Absolutely. Well, come down and see our iceberg. We're bringing over the tip of an iceberg from Greenland. So we'll definitely have you for an ice side chat, Lily.
I would love that. Thank you so much. Lots of love.
Thank you. Lots of love.
It was interesting because I had organized the Indigenous listening sessions within which Tom Goldtooth and Ariel Duranger spoke, and others, as listening sessions, as an opportunity to bring Indigenous voices to new communities and some of the leaders and thinkers at COP to try and influence them. I didn't really think that it was me who was going to have to do the listening, but actually coming out of the 2 weeks, my thoughts were so stirred by what the Indigenous communities had said, and in particular, the critique that Ariel and Tom had levelled at net zero targets and carbon offsets being used as a means to drive those targets. I was actually in Parliament in the UK in 2018, lobbying for the UK government to make a net zero goal, and have celebrated the fact that we have since, even if it doesn't feel ambitious enough. And whilst of course we need these net zero goals from governments and companies, if we are to efficiently decarbonize in the way that science demands. It's also so important to scrutinize the means to that end and to ensure that the goal doesn't become more important than the pathway to it. We need to look at reducing emissions, leaving fossil fuels in the ground, not allowing business as usual, which can just simply be offset. And so the whole concept of offsetting feels problematic, to say the least. To close this episode, I'm going to share a few words from Vanessa Nakate, the youth climate activist from Uganda that you met throughout Series 1. She has a new book out called The Bigger Picture, which speaks to loss, damage, and climate justice, particularly in Africa. And I highly recommend checking it out. This is what Vanessa said, reflecting on the Indigenous listening session.
There is something I always say in my activism. We cannot eat coal and we cannot drink oil. And I would really love to learn from the Indigenous leaders what we really need to understand when we say we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground, and to also learn from them what loss and damage really is.
Thank you for listening. This episode was made possible with the support of impossible.com, and our Indigenous listening session was made possible through the support of the Isla Foundation, grounded in the hard work of flourishing diversity. We'll be sharing more from our Indigenous listening sessions from COP26 in this podcast in the weeks to come, because the Indigenous voices are, to my mind, the real world leaders on climate that the world needs to listen to right now.